This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You've heard of drug addiction, alcohol addiction, even gambling addiction or porn addiction. But what about religious addiction? Apparently, that's a thing. When people who are religious become so emotionally dependent on their faith that they develop an unhealthy attachment, they literally become addicted to it. Well, that's the story of my guest, Elizabeth Esther, who's written a handbook of sorts about how to kick your religious addiction. Esther became known for her first book, Girl at the End of the World, My Escape from Fundamentalism in Search of Faith with a Future. And her new book is called Spiritual Sobriety, Stumbling Back to Faith When Good Religion Goes Bad. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So honestly, it was hard for me to kind of relate to your story. I grew up in a very non-religious household, practically atheist. And so when I started reading about your story, this was very fascinating to me. And of course, I'm sure many in our audience did grow up in similar households to yours, maybe not as religious, but somewhat religious, even ranging to some people who grew up in extreme religious households. So why don't we begin with hearing your story in a nutshell, how you were raised in terms of the faith that informed you and infused every aspect of your life.
Okay, yeah, I was born here in Southern California, 1977, which coincided with a religious movement that was happening at the time, the Jesus movement, which was basically a lot of people getting born again, which means like asking Jesus into their heart, going down to the beach and getting baptized in the Pacific Ocean. It was a very community-driven church started by my grandfather. And at the beginning, it was very idealistic and loving, and everybody was in it together. A lot of young couples and singles and new families. So it was just a young adult movement. And my grandfather sort of started that. As time went on, though, it began to spiral into what we call legalism, which is a very strict interpretation of religious practice and belief. And eventually by about the early 90s, and even really in the 80s, we had become very insulated, very rigid, very strict, didn't watch TV, obviously didn't drink alcohol, didn't dance, didn't listen to secular music, didn't watch very few movies, almost had an entirely separate subculture. And that's what I grew up in. It was also very physically abusive, especially to children. We had obedience was held in very high regard. So children were essentially spanked to the point where they were bruised. And in order to get obedience compliance.
Did that happen to you as well?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for years. And then the parent, you know, once you had a child, you were also trained to raise your child that way. I ended up leaving when I was 25. I got out. And that's kind of like what the first book discusses, was that childhood and being brought up in that.
Girl at the End of the World. That's the title of your earlier book. Yeah.
Correct. And so this book is more or less my way of trying to fumble my way back to some kind of faith practice and figuring out, you know, what went wrong? What was it that I grew up in? And I began to realize this happens to a lot of people. And so this book, Spiritual Sobriety, is sort of my way to say, hey, a healthy spiritual practice is possible.
And so let's talk about the hallmarks of religious addiction, because your book, Spiritual Sobriety, reads like a handbook for somebody who's been through what you went through and who essentially turned to religion as a crutch, much in the same way that a drug addict would rely on cocaine or heroin, or an alcohol addict would rely on, you know, scotch. How does religious addiction share hallmarks of sort of classic addiction that we know more about, the kind of standard forms of addiction?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that really what defines religious addiction is when religious beliefs or practices are used to numb pain, escape the present moment, avoid dealing with reality, avoid dealing with real life situations. sort of magical thinking. Also, when we use religious beliefs or practices as weapons against ourselves or others. One way that this manifests is a lot of like obsessive confession of sin, a kind of compulsive scrupulosity, if you will. And also, for example, there's a huge emphasis in my group in particular on end times theology, which is a whole sort of theology built around the end of the world happening. And and it's a way of avoiding reality, which was, you know, we didn't really want to live in the here and now. We were so consumed with going to heaven and being raptured into the skies with Jesus that it was a very convenient way for us to avoid living in the real world.
You also talk about trading with God. If I pray this much, then that will happen to me. You know, describe that a little bit more.
Yeah, I describe that as a transactional use of God, or like a vending machine God. Like you put obedience into the vending machine and out pops joy, happiness, prosperity. We see this very much right now in our culture, a very prosperity driven sort of gospel, or like if you do certain things, God's going to make you happy and wealthy and successful and have wonderful relationships and lifelong marriages. And it's very much an idea of I do this for God and he rewards me this way, which can become a very addictive way of living.
And it kind of seems to, at least, you know, it seems to be inconsistent with what one thinks of religion. You're supposed to, if you're religious, supposed to have this unconditional love for your creator, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's often, I think, very true of American Christianity today as we see it, which is associating religion with political victories, for example, or associating Christianity with wealth, or, you know, it's not for the better good of all. It's also not for current rewards here on earth. It's supposed to be because living this way is the good way to live. That's what you do if you have a good relationship with God, not because you're hoping to get something out of it, and also not because you're trying to avoid living in reality.
Now, can you describe the feeling that you and other people, you when you were in sort of submerged in this, and people who do get very steeped in these sort of in these religious practices, the feelings of euphoria that come when you are at religious meetings or the religious summer camp or conferences, and these feelings of euphoria that really, you know, are relatable to how a person feels when they get high, and then you come off of that high and it feels horrible.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I've had one too many of those experiences. And it's very common, actually, now. A lot of what big mega churches do is they're creating an experience-driven environment. So you have lights and music, and it's focused on this stage with an amazing worship band, and so the whole context of this is you go in there to have an experience almost similar to maybe what you would have at a music concert or a whatever it may be. But then there's these dynamic speakers that come forward and they tell you how your life is going to change and how with Jesus your life is going to be so much better, and all these false promises that you are given, and that it's when you're in that situation and you're having sort of this like mass communal experience with hundreds of other people, sort of the psychological dynamic that happens is you do experience this euphoria, this high. You walk out of there feeling like you have some grand purpose for your life. And it's happened to me so many times that just, you know, a couple days later, I'll have the post-conference crash and feel so depressed and empty and regret because I spent all this money on this conference, and kind of like this withdrawal, almost physical withdrawal of having to now deal with reality because nothing changed. I mean, nothing changed in my real day-to-day life. I just went to an event. And so, unfortunately, that was sort of a habit that I had gotten into after leaving the cult. We had similar experiences in the cult as well that I grew up in.
And you call it a cult.
I do call it a cult, yeah.
And so that sort of feeling of euphoria is what a lot of people who end up in these religions that turn into cults chase. You chase the euphoria just like an addict would chase a high.
Very much so. And I should also say that I've also experienced that sort of euphoria, that high, in other contexts as well. I began practicing yoga, and I realized at the end of that that I had a very similar sort of experience to it, which is one of the reasons why I couldn't do yoga anymore, because it was unhealthy for me. It was creating like a need, a craving for that. I think that when you have like an addictive personality, and especially if it manifests in a religious context, you kind of have to exercise a lot of moderation in any sort of stimulus that mimics that euphoric high.
And I want to get to the steps that you outlined in your book for how one can beat back religious addiction. But just for one more minute, I want to focus on the sort of hallmarks of addiction that can be applied to religious addiction, which is that when people get so caught up in the cultish aspects of religion, they make decisions that are very detrimental to their own lives. Just as, say, a drug addict or an alcohol addict might end up, you know, spending the bulk of their salary on the thing that feeds their addiction rather than, you know, saving money, putting it into a 401k. How do religious addicts make decisions that are really detrimental to themselves?
Yeah, that it's actually very tragic, because what happens is children that are in these groups end up being neglected, often physically abused. Spanking is very, very prevalent in a lot of these groups, and not even just cultish Christian groups, but also mainstream Christian groups. Spanking is very widely practiced. And so the way that the consequences of this sort of addiction is, it manifests itself in abuse, neglect, also, you know, not being able to take care of your daily responsibilities. I had people that when I grew up with, that they didn't save for retirement because they believed that Jesus was returning, so they had no savings. I've had other friends who...
And they would give their money to the church instead.
The church, correct. So the money was going to the church. The money was going to resources and curriculums and workbooks that were all promising to change your life. I mean, you could have an entire lifestyle, and it's still possible today. I mean, you could have an entire lifestyle of just going to Christian conferences, much like people would maybe go... be traveling or have a traveling lifestyle. Like this is an entire lifestyle that's available to Christians if you just want to spend your money that way.
So how does one beat back religious addiction? If those among our audience are listening to this interview, watching this interview, and thinking, wow, that kind of describes my life, and I do want to try to get out of it. Of course, I can imagine, as with any addiction, the first step is recognizing you have a problem.
Right, right. That's always the first step. And it's hard, because I think a lot of our identity can become wrapped up in religious context. And it's not just, the addiction doesn't just affect like something we just do on Sunday, but especially in these whole lifestyle sort of groups, it's everything. So it's hard to separate yourself from your addiction. And just becoming aware that there is a problem is the first step. And then I suggest you have to be very gentle, because with religious addiction especially, there's so much shame involved, and there's so much shame around sex, there's so much shame around relationships, there's so much shame around money, there's so much shame around self-care, and a religious addict coming out of that environment and wanting to live a more spiritually healthy, spiritually sober way of life, a lot of it, and for me especially too, it began with self-care. For a lot of people who are in these environments, almost the very first thing they neglect is basic self-care. Getting your physical, brushing your teeth, getting enough sleep, nutrition. These are all just very basic things that I had to start prioritizing because my health was breaking down. So it's a very gentle approach to recovery that I think is... We have to be very careful, because I wanted to recover really quick. And so I actually like almost channeled my addiction toward like, I'm going to recover and I'm going to do all this stuff and get better. And that actually just triggered another sort of compromised state where I could just fall back into the obsessive compulsive behaviors.
Now, interestingly, 12-step programs for the more traditional types of addictions that we're familiar with rely on faith, right? Can one have a faith-based 12-step addiction to get over religious addiction?
You know, there isn't one that exists right now, but I don't think it's necessary to have a specifically religious addicted, a 12-step program specifically for religious addiction, because one of the problems that religious addicts often face, and I'm speaking from personal experience, is we suffer from a sense of specialness. We think that God has chosen us. We think that our problems are more special than what other people go through. And so actually it's very humbling and very like grounding to be in a 12-step group, like maybe say Codependence Anonymous or something like that, because you're not centering around your religion. You're just centering around recovery and getting over just like almost like the codependent way you used God and religion. So I have found it to be, very humbling on the one hand to realize like, oh, I'm actually just like everyone else. I'm no better and I'm no worse. And I'm here to get better. So that's where I suggest finding something that you can work towards. It doesn't have to be specific to religious addiction.
Now, the subtitle of your book is Stumbling Back to Faith When Good Religion Goes Bad. You haven't given up your belief in God. You're not an atheist all of a sudden. You are still a believer, right?
I am. I am still a believer. And for better or for worse, I've tried to give up believing in God. For whatever reason, I can't.
And I mean, religion can be, for people who are religious, who are believers, religion can be a very constructive way in which to make sense of the world. It doesn't have to devolve into what you experienced. It can be a way to make sense of the world, to deal with tragedy constructively, right? I mean, it doesn't have to go the one way or the other.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, I think that truly is a truly healthy spirituality, is a moderate spirituality. Yes, it informs your life, but it doesn't dictate your life. And yes, it's possible. I mean, for me, and that's what I try to carry into my life is love for everyone, love for myself, acceptance, compassion, doing unto others as I would have them do unto me. That's sort of how I describe now. That's how I try to practice my daily life without getting into these futile theological arguments with people about, what exactly you believe and what exactly you ascribe to, because I find that just leads to a lot of disunity and a lot of needless fighting.
Finally, I'm wondering if you can put it into a bigger context, social context, for why people fall into religious addiction. Because a lot of times, I mean, this is just me, sort of my observations or anecdotal evidence. It seems to me that a lot of times people, enter these religious communities because they're looking for community. Because our American society, for whatever reason, historically we have a certain story, this country has a certain story, and our society is built a certain way, that we end up having, the kinds of communities that are most prevalent are built around religion. And then if you don't have a religious community, you can feel unmoored. Can you kind of talk about this broader social context in which religious addiction can develop?
I think our culture as a whole sets people up for religious addiction, truly, because, and I discovered this when I came out of the cult and into mainstream American society, it's very lonely out here. Hmm. Unless you belong to some academic group or some school or you have some built-in network of people that you know, and a lot of that does revolve around church. If you don't have that, America can be a very lonely place to be. And so I have a lot of compassion and understanding for people who find themselves enthralled and pulled into a religious community, because there is something there that we need as human beings, and we need that connection. We need that community. We crave it. Without it, we do suffer. We need each other. And so I think that really what has happened in our culture is we have become, it's very odd. It's very dualistic. On the one hand, we become very, very individualistic, like fiercely individualistic. And on the other side, we've become very polarized in our communities. So there's less and less reaching across the differences and more separating into these camps and who's in and who's out. And this kind of defines where people are and attributes to their identity and also their crisis of identity. So I think that a lot in our culture plays into that. It's something I'm very aware of. And I, in fact, I have to make a concerted effort to attach myself to healthy communities because otherwise it gets very lonely and I can find myself easily falling back into addictive behavior.
Well, Elizabeth, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us, and thank you for discussing your new book. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
My guest is Elizabeth Ester, and she's known for her earlier book, Girl at the End of the World, My Escape from Fundamentalism in Search of Faith with a Future. And her new book, which we've just been discussing, is called Spiritual Sobriety, Stumbling Back to Faith When Good Religion Goes Bad. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.